When last we left Joseph, which we did, and it actually, by the way, occurred to me that maybe the best thing to do would be not to go straight from the end of Genesis to the story of David, but to do probably the first either 12 or 20 some chapters of Exodus, because that's the Exodus and the Ten Commandments, and that would be worth doing. And then when we get to all the legal stuff, we can switch to David for now. Anyway, so when last we left him, he had just revealed himself to his brothers and asked them if his father was still alive, even though presumably he already knows that that is so. I think we got to verse, 16, is that true? 45, 16? I didn't mark it. This is after he embraced Benjamin and wept on his neck. So we're chapter 45, verse 16. The news reached Pharaoh's palace. Joseph's brothers have come. Pharaoh and his courtiers were pleased. Now, I wonder what they were pleased about. First of all, does he have any inkling of Joseph's history? Is he pleased because he figures this is a family reunion, or is he just pleased, you know, in the same way that if you like someone and you understand their family came to town and you don't have to host them, you're pleased? Sorry, did that slip out? I didn't. Right, exactly. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do as follows, load up your beasts and go at once to the land of Canaan. Take your father and households and come to me. I'll give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you'll live off the fat of the land. And you are bidden to add, do as follows. Take from the land of Egypt wagons for your children and your wives, and bring your father here, and never mind your belongings, for the best of all the land of Egypt shall be yours. Now, why is that? First of all, why does Pharaoh do that? Well, it could be that, you know, this is just the favoritism that you show to somebody who's your right-hand man. It also could be that even though later on Pharaoh is concerned about the population, the truth is that it was sparsely populated, Egypt, compared to now, and maybe he's trying to build up and bringing new clans into Egypt under his rule increases his power. And Canaan, for much of, you're spread out. I keep sweeping my eyes across the Canaan, for much of the time in the ancient world, was under the control of Egypt. You may not be aware of this, but remember that the reason that Israel was so important and so fought over is it's a land bridge between two great continents and two world powers. So you had Babylonia and Assyria, and then Babylonia, where northern Israel is now, and then, of course, to the south you had Egypt, and the two of them fought over Israel and its possession, sort of incidentally to other things, for a long, long time. I mean, if you ask why Jerusalem was so invaded, because what's Jerusalem? It's nothing. Israel is nothing. Israel is like a little tiny slip of a land. But it mattered for getting from one to the other. And most of the time, in the time of the Bible, Canaan was under Egyptian influence. It's anyway, so I'll leave it at that. But anyway, so for Pharaoh to want Canaanites to come to Egypt also makes sense. And that's why, presumably, he says that Joseph and his family should come. And also, there is another factor which wise rulers, and maybe some pharaohs were wise, makes sense that they were, which wise rulers have known, and that is that the most industrious, the most hardworking, the most adventurous populations are immigrant populations. It's the best and the brightest that come to new countries. The lazy and the lumpy and the unindustrious are much more likely to stay home than to go, right? It makes sense. So that's I mean, it's not a universal rule, obviously, that all immigrants are smarter than the people they leave behind. For example, the Jewish world lost its best Jewish minds in the Shoah, because the more traditional someone was, didn't matter how bright they were, the more traditional they were, the more likely they were to stay in Eastern Europe, right? Not to come to America, where they knew that traditions were corroded. But in general, immigration works as a sort of sifting process, right? The immigrants are the ones that want to make a better future for themselves and for their kids, and those are the ones that are more industrious. So maybe he thought that by bringing Joseph's family there, he would get an infusion of, you know, rich blood. As Saul Bellow says that in one of his novels, that he has rich blood. His father was a peddler. Okay, so the sons of Israel did so. Joseph gave them wagons as Pharaoh had commanded, and he supplied them with provisions for the journey. To each of them, moreover, he gave a change of clothing, but to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and several changes of clothing. Now he can give Benjamin, he can favor Benjamin openly, and what are they going to say, right? In addition to being his full brother, Benjamin also wasn't involved in his sale. So in both for both reasons, Benjamin is going to be the recipient of Joseph's favor. And to his father he sent the following: 10 he asses laden with the best things of Egypt, 10 she asses laden with grain, bread, and provisions for his father on the journey. And he sent his brothers off on their way. He told them, do not be quarrelsome on the way. Now, this line has occasioned, as you might imagine, a lot of commentary, because it does seem to come out of left field. All of a sudden, he says, by the way, don't fight with each other on the way. The usual comment, not the only one, but the usual comment is, don't spend your time blaming each other, because that's what they're going to do as soon as they're out of Joseph's. Well, if you hadn't said we should sell him, none of this would happen, right? And it is true when there's a collective ill and it turns out badly, you know, people start blaming each other. That's why administrations fall apart when, you know, things go wrong, because everybody in the administration is blaming everybody else in the administration, saying you're the one who came up with this crazy idea, right, to go to war or to push a health plan or whatever it may be. The other explanation that is often offered about this is just that Joseph knew the character of his brothers, and that we might assume that Joseph was the only one that they had a quarrel with, but it's very rare for somebody to be that angry only at one person and kind to everybody else. So Joseph may have understood that this is how they operate. They do fight with each other. They're now under a tremendous psychological pressure, and they're going to go home and face their father, who's going to wonder how Joseph got to Egypt. Because as far as he's concerned, right, Joseph was killed by a wild beast, and that, whether they ever tell Jacob or not, because the Torah never says whether the brothers or Joseph told Jacob what really happened, but whether they tell him or not, they're going to have to confront him and say Joseph is alive and face some uncomfortable questions, right? Didn't you bring me that bloody coat? Didn't you look around for him? How did he survive? Can't wait to talk to him and find out. So that also is going to be uncomfortable, and you can imagine that part of Joseph's fear is not just, I mean, he's not just being a nice guy, don't fight with each other, but he's also worried whether they will come intact to Joseph and to Jacob and really get Jacob there. Because what if they fight and they break up and some of them leave and only a few of them end up at home, and who knows if they're going to be able to get Jacob to Egypt? And remember that Pharaoh said, I want all your brothers to come back. So he doesn't also want to say, I know you wanted all my brothers, but I can only get 6 of them. That's not going to look good either. So there are a lot of motivations for Joseph to tell them not to fight on the journey. What interests me is Joseph saying to his brothers, don't fight on the journey, making it any less likely that they will fight on the journey, or more likely that they'll fight on? I mean, when a parent says to kids, don't fight, does that reduce at all the possibility that as soon as the door closes, the kids will fight? I don't think that this is Joseph's shining psychological moment here, although maybe, I mean, it's not as though he could get them not to fight by not saying anything. So it's interesting, at least, to think about what... the other commentary, which is always, since the Torah always operates on several levels, depending on how you're looking at it, is it says, don't be quarrelsome on the journey. And the journey can be not just the journey home and back, but through the years, you know, the various tribes and so on into the Messianic age, right? He could also be, it's Badarach, is, you know, just like when God says to Saul, when Saul loses his kingdom, what Samuel says is that God, Vayishlacha Hashem Badarach, and God has sent you on a journey. So, yes, it means that's true for Saul, but it's also true in general. I will, as soon as I finish the chapter, I'll take questions and comments. So hold on to it. Don't forget. They went up from Egypt and came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, and they told him, Joseph is still alive. He's ruler over the whole land of Egypt. Now, I mean, it's an unbelievable moment if you think about it. And the reaction is exactly what you would expect, which is his heart went numb, or his heart froze, for he did not believe them. The initial reaction is, of course, disbelief, because first, to know that Joseph is alive is unbelievable. To know that he's the ruler of Egypt is absurd. Absurd, right? He was lost as a 17-year-old child. And then it says, but when they recounted all that Joseph had said to them. Now, it says, kol divrei Yosef, everything that Joseph said. If, in fact, that description is literal, then, of course, they're going to have to tell him, you know, more than, they're going to have to tell him what happened. But Jacob never reacts to that. He never says, remember, this is the same Jacob who got really upset at Shimon and Levi when they carried out the massacre in Shechem. Very upset, and made his upset very verbal, and says it again during the blessings at the end of the book of Genesis, right? So he's not reluctant to tell his children when he thinks they've done wrong, and yet he says nothing that indicates that he knows that they did wrong. So when it says they told them everything that Joseph said, everything might mean that he actually described Joseph's journey, and it might mean that he just said, you know, I'm ruler and bring my father and so on and so forth. We don't know. But when they recounted all that Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to transport him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. Enough, said Israel. My son Joseph is still alive. I must go and see him before I die. So it's a very, as I said, it's a very powerful moment. But it's also, of course, a decisive moment in the history of Israel, because this is what's going to bring them to Egypt, is Joseph's decision at that moment to go. And also, it's the eventual fulfillment of Joseph's dream. Because remember that the second dream was that his parents would bow down to him too. The first dream was just his brothers, but the second dream included his parents. Now, his mother has died, but his father's coming. So, in a sense, even though there's more, and we're going to see more, and there's an amazing scene after this in some ways, but that's the story of Joseph, in a sense, culminates here. Now it's, you know, now it's the epilogue, where there's the happy ending, where everybody comes together. I mean, the next episode is going to be very unhappy, but this episode is the happy ending, and the way that it's accomplished is through Joseph's testing of his brothers, and through the brothers going back and being better than they were before. And presumably, they didn't quarrel very much on the way, since they all come to Jacob and they all tell him that Joseph is still alive. Okay, so let's take a break for a minute and take a couple questions.
I have a different translation of don't fight on the road.
Okay.
And what they've said here is, don't be anxious along the way.
No.
I wonder, is that just a mistranslation?
No. No, it's tirgazu, which could mean anxious, but I would say it's an interpretive translation. It's not the most likely translation. Whose translation is it?
The Women's Commentary. Hmm.
It's funny because they use the JPS translation, but I guess they make specific changes. But okay, I think that's a less likely. I mean, in modern Hebrew, in fact, in Yiddish, any of you know Yiddish, breiges means angry with someone, right? So that's what this—that's from this same root, tirgazu. But okay. I mean, it could mean not be angry, not fight, not be anxious, but he says don't be anxious later, and I think that the more likely, I think that the reason they translate it this way is the more likely directive to someone is action rather than feeling, but who knows? Yeah.
When the brothers tell Jacob the words of Joseph, the text says, Asher diber aleihem, not lahem.
That's not common. It is a common biblical locution to say aleihem. But yeah, I mean, it literally means on you. Right. But you get both. You do get both. Biblical Hebrew is very, I don't know, it sounds stilted to someone who speaks modern Hebrew, but I don't know what to say more than that. Well, not the first time, because remember, he's already had the quarrel with the angel long before, who names him. But it is interesting to see when he's named Jacob and when he's named Israel. And generally speaking, it's when he represents the people that he's named Israel, as he does here. and this is the moment when the tribes coalesce to become a nation, which is actually, this is kind of interesting if you think about it. The only other time we think of them as a separate nation is with Shechem. And I have to think about this more carefully. This is just sort of coming to mind. But you think of yourself as a separate nation when you come in contact with another nation. You sort of, bless you, you don't think of yourself as a family unit until you come in contact with another family unit. I mean, that's when a kid goes to sleeps at someone else's house, they all of a sudden learn what their family does. Because they didn't realize that actually some people don't have cereal for breakfast. They thought, you know, breakfast is cereal and cereal is breakfast. And then they go to someone else's house and they have waffles and they go, oh my God, other families work differently, which gives you a sense of what your own family is, right? For good and for bad. It's the same reason that when you marry somebody and they come into your family, you learn a lot about your own family because you see them through the eyes of somebody who didn't grow up in that family, doesn't have that assumption. So the same thing here, which is one of the reasons why Israel now is becoming a people, is because they're going to be stuck in the middle of another culture, and then they're going to realize what's distinctive about what they do, which otherwise is sort of unthinking. This is just what we do, and it isn't until you see that other people don't do that at all that you realize that it's strange or different or unique. Yeah.
It could be by Joseph telling his brothers not to quarrel. He was telling them that he knew their character.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that Joseph's experience, first of all, his experience of his brothers is obviously that they quarreled with him, but also you've got to think, you can almost imagine the scene based in part on what's in the Bible, but also just based on your imagination. Okay, I'm Joseph, you're the brothers. One thing that you don't know, according to the commentaries, is that I speak Hebrew. So I'm talking to you and saying, do you have a father, right? Because you've tried to keep your father out of it, or do you have another brother? Because you've tried to keep your brother out of it. And what are you gonna say? You're gonna say to the guy next to you, you idiot, I told you not to mention the brother, right? very, I mean, and there are all sorts of rabbinic commentaries that emphasize this idea that the brothers quarreled in front of Joseph, but they didn't know that Joseph knew what they were saying because they thought Joseph was an Egyptian. So how would he know what they were saying? And so he may have seen their quarrelsomeness anyway, and he was making a comment on their character based on what he observed even then. Just one second.
I wonder if there isn't another point of view about Joseph. He's strongly narcissistic, I suspect, that he was a beautiful man and he knew who he was. And he might have been telling his brothers, don't quarrel, don't be whatever. You will be reflecting on me, and I only want good to be reflecting. I don't want this other stuff, because we will be seen by other people. We're now separating ourselves, and we're going to be judged by how you look.
Well, it's certainly true. I mean, let me separate off the two parts of what you said. Is Joseph a narcissist? I mean, there's certainly a lot of evidence that he is. And the rabbi certainly, I mean, there's a lot of midrashim about how Joseph couldn't pass a mirror without looking at himself. Which makes him either a narcissist or an inhabitant of the 21st century. One of the two, I don't know. Drew, any of you remember the beginning of the Patty Duke show? Remember how she would go by the mirror, right?
Yeah.
And the two of them would. Anyway, so what's that?
What happened? Someone don't know about that.
Oh, they were twins, and they would go by the mirror and imitate each other's actions.
They were cousins,
right? Identical cousins, and you'll find, right? They talk alike, they walk alike at times. Yeah, right, exactly. So I'm not going to sing it for you. So he could have been a narcissist, but that might not have. You don't need to be a narcissist to feel that your family reflects on you. That's why you can be embarrassed by your parents, and other people's parents don't embarrass you. It's what Freud called the narcissism of small differences. That is, if you're like me, what you do reflects on me. But if you're not, why do Jews get embarrassed when other Jews steal or whatever? Because they're too close. And so for Joseph, he's not going to like it that his brothers quarrel. Although, who would see them on the journey? I don't know. I guess you've got to assume that the Egyptians, since they sent wagons and material and so on, Pharaoh also must have sent servants and people who are in the end going to report back to him. I assume that that's true. And it looks like Pharaoh hears everything that goes on. But on the question of Joseph's character, even though we're not done with the story, you can read him in really in different ways. I'll have to see if I can find, I used to have it and I don't know that I can find it now, but Maurice Samuel has an essay on Joseph, and he really, really doesn't like him. And he really, I mean, I'll try to dig it up. He says very negative things about him. On the other hand, the rabbis call him Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph the Righteous One. So, yeah.
It seems to me that part of that, why it would work with if Joseph says don't quarrel, if his dad says, if Jacob says don't quarrel, Jacob always had trouble holding on to his authority. He was very insecure, very scared a lot of the time. Joseph has gone through a time where he has a commanding voice. He's developed it. He's been away from these guys. And I imagine that the way it's like when somebody else comes in or a good teacher comes in after a class that nobody could control.
And he can.
Say, by the way, don't quarrel. Don't argue with each other. And all of a sudden, people have their attention. They would really, Joseph had managed to get their attention in ways to unify them because he's used to being heard and commanding power.
It does bring to mind two, first of all, as you say, Joseph now is used to being in control, and when you're used to being in control, you both say things in a way that people listen to, but also you assume they'll listen whether they will or not, just because, Joseph is surrounded by sycophants. Everybody is telling Joseph what a wonderful person he is because he's the ruler. But the other thing is there was a study done recently that I remember I read about in the paper or in some journal. They took people's empathy and identification with other people. And they studied what happens to them when they ascend like the corporate ladder. And what happens is, when they're equal horizontally with someone else, they're much more attuned to their emotions. But as they step up the ladder, they become much less attuned to people's emotions. So if you're a secretary, you'll notice when another secretary is upset. If you get promoted, you'll walk by that same secretary and not notice that they're upset. And that's a sort of universal phenomenon. It just and they studied the same people as they moved up the ladder on all these indices of empathy, what they have, you know, how much you ask people about their lives and whether you notice when they're upset and if you, all those things. And so what this made me think of is, first of all, how true it is and how much I see it in my own life. I mean, I'm much more likely, if a congregant comes in, to notice emotionally their reactions than I am if I walk through the office to notice the emotional tenor of the people who are in the office. And I didn't realize that that was true until I read this article. And that one of the wonderful things I remember my psychology teacher in college told us was that the great thing about psychological rules with human beings is once they know them, then they can break them. Because once you know that you're likely to do something, then you can reverse. Like there's, he was using as the example, the more people that are around somebody who's in trouble, the less likely any individual is to help them. He said, but now that you know that, you can be more likely to help them, because when you see a lot of people around, you know no one else is likely to do it. So so that was the first thing that it made me think. But the reason that I bring all this up is that it might just be that Joseph is unattuned to the emotional constitution of his brothers, and he just says, in the way that people are used to being listened to, don't fight, assuming that that will work because he's not used to being aware of people's emotional needs, which he was very good at in prison and in Potiphar's house, or at least maybe was good at in prison and Potiphar's house. Okay, so let's go with people who haven't asked anything yet. I'll go across. Maybe. It may be that Jacob doesn't care. Maybe. Or maybe he had his own suspicions. Or maybe he remembers that he sent Joseph to them in the first place. So maybe he feels like he's partly culpable too. Yeah. Oh, I see. That's nice. I like that. What Miriam said was that maybe he's saying this to himself, because it says after he sent them and they walked, and then it says, and he said to them, don't fight along the way. So you could imagine the scenario that they leave, and he's watching them walk, and he's saying, don't fight on the way. Just don't. Please don't fight on the way. And that actually, that would make a very, that's a wonderful director's interpretation of how this, you know, you could do it. You could see it being done. Yes.
I'm going to move away from that just for a moment.
Sure.
And talk about gifts that we're given. And at times we use them, you know, at a very immature stage, such as dreams or visions, mm-hmm. and interpretations of those. And Joseph seemed to be, you know, obviously hubris and overly zealous in the initial interpretation, which got him in trouble.
Yeah.
Then he travels at 17 to 30, and again has an opportunity. And what amazes me is that now he's using it more in a mature way. He didn't sit and beat himself up, or maybe he did. I don't know, but, you know, we've got a time right. We don't know. But what I'm really amazed at is that gift that he had was the gift that obviously brought him into power.
Right. Well, okay, so let me make quick comments on both. First, about the gifts, that Joseph's dreams get him in trouble and get him out of trouble. You know, the beautiful interpretation that I mentioned before of Isaac Bernstein is that when he only listened to his own dreams, he got in trouble. It's when he started to listen to other people's dreams that he started to come get out of trouble and grow. But I think everybody knows, and actually I have a perfect illustration of this because I went to see Wicked last night, the show, and if you watch it, it's among many other themes, one of the themes is the ways that gifts can get you in trouble and get you out of trouble. Everybody knows that giftedness is a double-edged sword, and in fact, I read you once that Delmore Schwartz poem, which I don't think I have a copy of, but it was in his journal. Delmore Schwartz was a poet. No, I don't have it, but I think I remember it. Delmore Schwartz was a poet who went mad. He was a contemporary of Saul Bellows and others, and he was a brilliant poet early on. He wrote a story that's anthologized in every American short story literature called In Dreams Begin Responsibilities, and which is a phrase from the poet Yeats, but it's a beautiful, it's a powerful story. Anyway, so in his journals, Schwartz, who, as I said, he had this great poetic gift, but he went crazy, and in fact, Bella wrote a novel about him called Humboldt's Gift. He has a poem about Joseph, and he says, "The gift is loved, but not the gifted one. The coat of many colors is admired by all, but he who wears the coat is not kept warm." So there, everybody loved his poetic gift, everybody praised it, but it didn't help him. He was probably a paranoid schizophrenic. I mean, he really was like one of those people who in our day would have all his teeth removed and would live in a, you know, apartment and not see anyone. It was very sad, his decline. But having said that, so yeah, gifts are double-edged. They really are. The second half about the moral law, this is a theme all through Genesis, but it's pretty clear that the Torah assumes, I mean, the rabbis have different explanations for this, that some of the Torah was known, some of it wasn't, but it's pretty clear that the Torah assumes that people have a moral sense independent of the giving of the Torah, because why does God get upset at Cain for killing Abel? Why does God get upset at the Tower of Babel for hubris? There are lots of moral judgments in Genesis before the Torah comes. So that's absolutely the case. And this is one more example where both Joseph and his brothers, you're supposed to make moral judgments about them, even though they haven't gotten the Torah yet. So, yes. Well, the question was, isn't it reminiscent of Jacob and Esau when Joseph and Benjamin see each other? In which is, by the way, this week's Torah portion. So nicely done. I suppose it's reminiscent in the sense that brothers are embracing and they haven't seen each other for many, many years. The great difference, of course, was this is the case, maybe it's sort of the mirror version. This is the case where there was no hostility between the two of them, because they were full siblings who never mistreated one another, whereas Jacob and Esau are full siblings who did. But other than that, I don't know. I don't know. It's an interesting question. I have to think more about it. But at first, it seems to me that they're different cases. Although one thing that it does bring to mind, which is very interesting, is that in the book of Genesis, in a lot of ways, siblings are more important than spouses. If you ask about the drama of Genesis, it has more to do with siblings, especially brothers, than it does to do with husbands and wives. And I don't know why that is. That's worth thinking about, but let's save it for now and pick it up another time. Yes.
So if all of this story had not happened, the brothers didn't throw him in the well instead of Egypt, would the history of Judaism be the same? I mean, he was really the disciple.
Right. So in the Sfirot, which are the God's emanations, Joseph is Malchut, which means kingship, which suggests in some ways that all of this was, you know, had to be. And the question that you ask could be asked of any biblical story, which is, if it didn't happen this way, would history be different? The short and easy answer is no one knows, and there's no way to know. And The longer sort of theological answer is that this brings up the question of free will. Did God make all this happen because God wanted a certain end? Or did God desire a certain end and was going to get it, but human beings had their choice of how to get there? Or are both true? That is, human beings had free will, but God knew what was going to happen. In the same way that if you're, for example, if you're standing on a bridge and you see a train headed towards another train, the two trains are headed to each other at 100 miles an hour, and you know they're going to crash, does that mean the conductors don't have free will? No, it just means that you can see the consequences of their choices even before they can see them. So there are a lot, but this is a complicated, and I'm not sure there's any completely satisfactory answer. It's a complicated issue, but I would say the way maybe best to describe it is from the other end, which is Joseph's choices determined Jewish history. Had he not made those choices, we don't know what would have happened. But yeah, this is this is a turning point. And Joseph's brother's choices, obviously, too. The Torah never presumes that only good choices lead to good results, right? Sometimes disastrous, murderous, awful choices lead to good results, too, which is just part of the complication of life. That's true in life, and it's true here. So, that's why Joseph says to the brothers explicitly, you meant it for ill, but God meant it for good. So, which doesn't let them off the hook, but also tells them that it's okay, that it turned out all right. Yes. He's always talking about God, yes. Joseph mentions God constantly, which is one of the reasons why the rabbis call him Yosef HaTzadik. And you can also imagine that Joseph must feel that he has God's providential care, because look at the extraordinary arc of his life. You know, I mean, he has everything going against him except what we would consider maybe his native talents, but what Joseph would consider God's watching over him, and maybe those two are the same thing. So he has to, you know. He also, it's not only his talents; it's also his good fortune. I mean, had he not come across the cupbearer and the baker, and had he not landed somehow in Potiphar's house, a lot of things happened.
I like that question about what would have happened. But it seems to me we would become Jews, because that's why Jacob became Israel. God told us we were going to struggle, and there would be adversarial relations, and somehow that's who we were. And if it wasn't one story, it would have to be another.
Okay. I mean, I have no problem with the idea that one way or another we would have ended up being Jewish, especially because it's an unanswerable question. There are a bunch of novels that are counterfactuals, just like there are some historical anthologies that are counterfactuals, where people say, you know, what if America had lost the Second World War, or what if the Black Plague hadn't broken out, you know, what if the disease-carrying rat had died in infancy, you know, or on and on and on, and they're interesting and they're suggestive, but the problem is history can be so contingent. Like the pacifistic King Alexander was bitten by his monkey and died, and his successor started a war that killed I don't know how many people, let's say it was 1 million people, I don't remember the figure now, and afterwards Churchill said 1 million people died of that monkey bite. So the point is that things can be so random and so contingent, and who knows what could change the course of history. I mean, something very small, something very simple. Remember that all of the Arab Spring was started by that one guy, right, in Tunisia, who was fed up. So what if he hadn't been fed up? What if he, you know... Yeah, exactly. What if he felt good that day? Does that mean all the Arab Spring wouldn't have happened? Well, something probably would have happened eventually, but it could have been very, very different. Better or worse, I don't know. Although with the elections in Egypt, I'm thinking it probably couldn't have gotten worse. But we'll see. We'll see. For those of you who don't know, the Islamists and the conservatives won a fairly decisive victory, and even repudiating the people who started the insurrection in Egypt. So not a real promising result in the Middle East this morning. The whole election thing is overrated, you know. Yeah, the democracy thing, you know, it really, I don't understand what's all this about democracy. Yeah. It could well be. It could well be. I don't want to get into an Iranian discussion in Bible class, but you could be right. Who knows? Who knows? The only thing that I know for a fact is that nobody knows what's going to happen, and people who predict and tell you and make confident assertions, you know, I mean. I cannot tell you how many people who know, and I underline know, have told me over the past 3 years that the bombing of Iran's nuclear facility, it's imminent. Just wait. Next, I'm telling you, in Israel and in America, I know, I'm in touch with the top people, believe me, next week, I mean, it's just, you know that there's a psychologist who did a study, I think I mentioned this before, did a study of political and economic punditry of people who make predictions. And among the experts, their predictions were actually worse than random. Worse than random. The future has far too many contingencies for anybody to tell you what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen. It's the same reason why we had a country full, chock full of experts on the Soviet Union. Who did nothing but study the Soviet Union, and overnight it collapsed, and nobody predicted it. Nobody. There was nobody who was saying the Soviet Union's about to collapse. It's just, I mean, so, you know, who knows? Yes. I have no doubt that there are predictions that the Third World War starts from Iran, but again, what you find is that there are predictions about timing and about countries and about, I mean, this, by the way, is even more common in Christianity than in Judaism, because the book of Revelations, if you look in it, allows you to predict almost anything, like the same thing with Nostradamus. All good predictors do that. Why? Well,
this is 40 years ago, and we were just back from a trip to America, and we said, Grandma, nobody knows Iran.
Right.
We were just there in America speaking, and they would say, what language it is? We would say Persian. They would say, what? Iran. Where? Nobody knew
right.
Where Iran was 40 years ago in this country.
Yeah.
And we would tell our Grandma, nobody knows Iran. How can you say that it says World War III starts from Iran? And she would say,
well, there are successions of empires, and it does say that the Messiah will come after the last empire, but all the rabbis interpreted the last empire as being Rome, because that's the empire they lived in, because they knew about the Persian Empire, the rabbis, but it was back in the time of Cyrus. And since then, right.
Now it brings chills to me that back then she said that, and now everybody knows.
Let me put it this way. Your grandmother is as likely to be right as George will, okay? Nobody knows. So, and also I'll leave it at that. Nobody knows. You know, but you know, but I will remind you about what Churchill said, since I quoted him once before. He said, I don't know what weapons the Third World War will be fought with, but I know which weapons the war after that will be fought with, sticks and stones. So, yes, it is. Yeah, we still have time. Yes, I agree, but hold on to that, because I still want to finish it to make Jen... No, that's okay. So let's look at the opening scene, and then I want to get to the end of the Joseph story before we discuss it as a whole, and we really are getting close. So Israel set out with all that was his. He came to Beersheba, where he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. God called to Israel in a vision by night, "Jacob, Jacob." He answered, "Hineni, I am here." And he said, "I am God, the God of your father. Fear not to go down to Egypt, for I will make you there into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I myself will also bring you back, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes." Now, there's so much here. First of all, what he's saying to him is, don't be afraid to go. This is meant to be. I will be with you. And there are, obviously, it depends which Bible scholar you believe. Some Bible scholars say that this was written at a time when people still thought of God as a territorial God. So it was God was literally leaving Canaan and going down to Egypt with Jacob and then would come back with him. Others say, no, you know, the rabbinic interpretation is that God is just saying, you're not going to go there alone. I'll be with you because I'm everywhere and you don't know that, but you'll see that I'll be in Egypt too. Doesn't matter what the Egyptians say about their gods, I'm going to be there too. But it's clear that God is, if not directing the history, at least approving of the history and saying, you'll go down, you'll come back, and also Joseph will be there. Joseph is alive. Joseph will be there when you die. You'll die in Egypt. It'll be okay. And eventually, you know, there'll be this huge exodus. And it's that persuades Jacob then to leave to Beersheba. Before that, he doesn't seem that ready to go. He's afraid to, and you can understand why. Also, he's an old man. And this is a long journey. It's not an easy thing to do, right? People don't want to leave. So it's not just that Joseph is alive, but also that God tells him that he can go. All right, so yeah, let's take a last question, and then we'll... He did, but look at the next. You're talking. Well,
he doesn't see, like, why would God come to him? He's like, I'm ready. I'm like, I'm going. And then
because God sees into the heart. That's what it says in Samuel. So presumably God knows that he's afraid, although, as Harold Kushner points out, that's the most common thing that God says to people in the Bible, is don't be afraid. So. Other than literally, God said to Moses, the most common phrase is, don't be afraid, Al Tira. So, it might be, I also I think that maybe it is that, you know, he says, of course, right away, I've got to go, but then they start packing for the journey, and then he thinks about how long it is to go. I don't know. Whether God tells you not to be afraid if you're not already afraid is a good question. That would be disconcerting. I wasn't scared until he told me not to be. Now I wonder what is there to be afraid of. I was fine, God, until you mentioned that. But all right, one more. Yeah.
Tell Jacob he's going to die down in Egypt.
Yes, he does tell Jacob that he's going to die down in Egypt. Although I think that Jacob assumes that he's not coming back. I mean, it's such a long journey for an old man to take. So it's not unusual to think that. If you think about it, you know, Tfilat HaDerech, the prayer for the way, I mean, that was written at a time when every journey was really perilous. And we don't live in that world, but most people did. Okay.